The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is the James Gray Show with the Lords Taverners.
You're listening to a podcast edition of the James Gray Show. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio on DAB Digital, online, or on your Alexa smart speaker. And if you're listening to the podcast, do leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Love Sport.
It wasn't quite so lush and green at Edgbaston yesterday. It was more dry and dusty and hot and all these things which should have favoured India. But they didn't. England triumphed, of course, Johnny Bairstow with that marvellous 100. Sam Morshead, digital editor of the Cricketer magazine, is on the line now. And Sam, your record's still going.
I know, isn't it great, James? Hello, how are you?
Yeah, I'm very well. Sam has been, every time he's been to watch England this year, they have won in the World Cup, and his colleagues have all been harbingers of doom. So I hope that we've rejigged the schedule to make sure that you continue that sort of form, Sam.
I know, 5 out of 5, isn't it? It's not too bad. Yeah. I'd like to class, but I think probably Liam Plunkett is more of a reason than me. But unfortunately, I will not be at Durham on Wednesday, so we'll see whether the run comes to an end.
Oh, Sam, you're killing me. you mentioned Plunkett there. Bairstow took all the headlines in the back pages for obvious reasons, but how important was Plunkett's role in that game?
We know what Liam Plunkett can do in middle overs of one-day international cricket. He's fantastic with an ageing ball, if not particularly old ball. In surfaces which can offer the batsman plenty of runs, he can put it short of the length, cross seamers, mixing his pace, just bringing the batsman into playing dodgy shots. And he got Virat Kohli playing a dodgy shot. And what can you say? That was a major reason in England turning the tide when Rohit and Kohli were looking particularly potent.
In the first innings, were you surprised that you didn't see more of that from the Indian seamers? Do you think they got it wrong on the day?
I think maybe they got it wrong bowling two spinners, particularly with a very short boundary on one side. England just took to both Chahal and Kuldeep Yadav throughout their spells. I mean, their first 4 or 5 over spells particularly each were hammered into that short stand. So maybe that India will regret that selection. They didn't have an extra seamer to play. Vijay Shankar wasn't in the side. So that was another option that potentially they could have gone to in previous games if they wanted to take a little bit of pace off the ball, but still use a seamer. So I think it partly team selection, partly England just bowled a bit better, with the exception of Jasprit Bumrah, who's just extraordinary.
In terms of England going forward, how much will they take from that performance into New Zealand game? I mean, I suppose, is it as simple as, well, when we have Jason Roy, it changes the way we bat?
Yes. I think that's fundamentally true. Just at the top of the order, when he's there, not only does he put more of an aggressive persona at the top of the innings, but he also allows Johnny Bairstow to become a bit uncaged. He can play a little bit slower at the start of his knock, build himself into a groove, and then go harder. When he's batting with James Vince, Bairstow can sometimes be a little bit more restrained. He's the senior partner. He's the one with the weight of expectation on his shoulders. That can restrict him a little bit. But when Roy is there, those two just bat beautifully together. And you only have to look at the numbers. They've batted 30 times together in one-day internationals, 16 times. They've gone past 59 of them a century stands. They're averaging 65 as a pair, and they're striking together at over 100. It's just a remarkable duo at the top of the order, and it's because of Roy that Bairstow plays so well.
In terms of why Bairstow played that well, look, I always looked at it and thought he's a guy who likes having a chip on his shoulder, but I was then slightly puzzled to see afterwards he sort of claimed that he was quoted out of context, which is almost the sort of set menu for how you deal with these media storms. But I kind of thought Bairstow was a bit above that. Do you think he did get blown out of all proportion?
I wasn't there for the interview in question. A number of my colleagues were, and the general consensus is that they don't feel that he was misinterpreted, misconstrued, what have you. So whatever Bairstow wants to do to make sure that he's motivated and that he's going out to bet as best as he can for his country in a World Cup, I think that's absolutely fine with everyone, because I can guarantee you that there isn't a single member of the England press pack who does not want this team to win the World Cup.
Yeah, agreed. And just finally, his opening partner, Jason Roy, obviously was playing through a hamstring injury and then a blow. He couldn't field, unfortunately, because he got hit by a ball. That was very unfortunate, or fortunate, depending on your point of view. England manipulating the system there, as everyone does now. How fit will he be? Have you heard word of how fit he should be for New Zealand on Wednesday?
In terms of the hamstring, it's got through it okay. He's not batting 100% fit, but you know he's fit enough to play the shots that he's needed to play at the top of the order. And for that blow on the hand, yeah, I mean, he had a bruise. Therefore, it's enough to be able to keep him off the pitch and for the umpires to be satisfied by the book that he can be kept off the pitch. But it's nothing more serious than that, as you would expect. So it's not going to keep him out of the game on Wednesday, that's sure.
Brilliant. Sam, thank you so much. If you could arrange to be up in Durham, even if you're not at the cricket, just get there somehow, mate. We clearly need you. Sam Moore said there, digital editor of The Cricketer magazine, and a very, very lucky charm for England during the World Cup so far. Every single time he's gone to cover England, they've won. When he hasn't, and some of his other Cricketer magazine colleagues have gone, they've lost. So, with the greatest of respect to, you know, the Hugh Turbervilles of this world, back out, lads. Just let Sam do it. It's very obvious that he's the man to do it. Now, the man who didn't do it, of course, was Virat Kohli. Now, he got himself a half century and then got himself out to Liam Plunkett. Show me a good loser and I'll show you a loser, someone much cleverer and, frankly, far more competitive than me once said. Virat Kohli, one of the great winners in cricket, showed yesterday he's far from a good loser by complaining about the size of the boundaries. It's worth pointing out that Kohli's concerns, we believe, were raised before the game started, or at least on his behalf. We saw Ravi Shastri, Sanjay Banga and Bharat Aaron, who represent the Indian coaching panel, basically. They were having words with the head groundsman, Edgbaston, right back on Saturday. India arrived at the ground and they were seen talking to the groundsman. We don't know exactly what about. I always think, as any side, a groundsman's a good person to talk to because they will just chit-chat about the pitch itself and you can try and pick up a bit of information. But I would have thought they were also questioning the boundary. Frankly, he would have said, well, sorry, Gov, not my decision. It's the ICC. Remember that throughout this World Cup, all of the playing conditions are set by the ICC. You know, the groundsmen get their instructions from there, the size of the plot, which strips to use. Everything comes from the ICC. So also remember that this is the same ICC who gave the Indian cricket team an extra week off because they had to play the IPL until quite close to the World Cup. That doesn't take into account the fact that South Africa had five first-team players in the IPL final. Apparently that didn't matter in the grand scheme of things. So maybe Kohli was just surprised that he didn't manage to influence the ICC to make it a more suitable condition for India, forgetting probably that it's called the International Cricket Council, not the Indian Cricket Council. I admit, frankly, the way they treat India sometimes, it would be easy to make that mistake. And now I'm all for whinging, you know, especially after a defeat. I'm a great whinger. I would say it's probably my best sporting skill, having a good whinge. But this is pathetic, you know, because India have lost for the first time in this Cricket World Cup. And instead of criticising his own batting or his teammates' batting or their failure to kick on during any stage of their innings or his own spinners failing to control the English batsmen, worth pointing out, by the way, that Chahal was hit for six times and returned the worst ever figures for an Indian bowler at a Cricket World Cup. 10 overs, none for 88. So instead of picking out all that and going, yeah, we actually weren't that good on the day, which is true, he decided to criticise one of the few in cricket, very few elements, that's the same for both sides. Honestly, the pitch evolves, it makes the toss important. The weather changes, which can sometimes give an unfair, although, you know, not controllable, advantage one way or the other. The boundaries don't move. They don't evolve, they don't cloud over, and in this case, they're not even set by the home team. So he really is just screaming into a vacuum here. He's got no excuse whatsoever. India were outplayed. England batted well. They fielded well. They bowled sensible lengths. They worked out the pitch. That kind of pitch, by the way, India should have worked it out. India should have looked at it and gone, Well, this is, okay, it's this sort of pitch. You know, not an unfamiliar one. A type of track we see a lot in India where there isn't a huge amount in it. You've got to try and bowl into the surface, bowl lots of cutters, lots of slower balls, mix it up as a seamer. You know, it did spin a bit as well. We saw some of that, but England just took their spinners to task. So you know what? And this isn't the first time I've got annoyed with Virat Kohli in this World Cup. Stop telling fans who to boo and who to applaud. Stop trying to manipulate conditions so they're even further in your favour, because let's face it, they're almost always in your favour, than they already are. And just get on with it. Start playing some cricket. Start scoring some hundreds. Sort your middle order out. Don't start complaining about things which are the same for everyone.
Love Sport.
It's time for us to introduce a new little segment here on Love Sport. It's time for the mystery voices. You're going to hear three voices. You've got to try and identify who is speaking in each one. Ben, fire away.
I don't mind.
I'm good, man.
Please, I'm happy with that.
That is so... Oh, that is so... Can you play it one more time, please, Ben?
I don't mind.
I'm good, man.
Please, I'm happy with that.
Okay, I've got one of them, I think. Now, it's time to talk a little bit of Chelsea, because Frank Lampard still isn't Chelsea manager, which is just something I assumed I wouldn't be saying by this time. Nini FC from Blue Lions TV is on the line. Nini, I think I assumed that we'd be chatting about Frank Lampard, the new Chelsea manager, by now. Somehow we're not.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you'd think. I know that Mel Morris came up to state that Lampard being on holiday was the reason why the deal has been held up for so long. And I think that I read somewhere that there's like financial fair play issues as well. I think some forms have to be filled out beforehand. So like these new signings are made for like the new financial year or something. And I'm paraphrasing really poorly. So I can understand why there's like a hold up and a delay, but you know, from what Mel Morris is saying today, it's a matter of time. I think maybe in the next day or two, Lampard should be officially appointed and announced. So, yeah, I'm not panicking too much, to be honest.
Are you surprised that it hasn't got over the line very quickly? I mean, I kind of assumed once Derby had said, OK, you can talk about it, it would just, everything would fall into place.
Yeah, but I think that's what Mel was saying, because Lampard's been on holiday. And it's understandable, you know, in the Championship, it's like, you know, you're playing 44 games, you know, travelling constantly up and down. And it's quite an intense season. It starts quite early, finishes quite late as well. So, you know, Frank does deserve to have a bit of a rest before he takes up an even bigger job for next season.
What do you think of as an appointment on the whole? Is it the right time, the right appointment for Chelsea?
I think it's a perfect appointment. The best appointment we could make. I think with the conditions at the club right now, with the transfer ban, with the influx of very young, talented players now that need to get game time and opportunities for the first team. And, you know, I think all those factors play a part. And I think that Lampard really complements all of those different factors. And I think that with his appointment, he's finally going to help us hopefully introduce some, you know, long-term stability at this club. And I think the best way of doing that is by blooding a lot of these young players, get them integrated into the team quickly so they can start becoming, you know, the staples of the first team.
I noticed you tweeting a little bit earlier today about potentially someone like Mason Mount coming in and playing in a 4-2-3-1. How ready do you think he is to come and take that number 10 role for Chelsea?
I think he's definitely ready. I think Mason Mount, I think he's really going to surprise quite a lot of Chelsea fans because he's been playing in Holland and in the Championship. I think maybe certain players like that, their skill set gets a bit undervalued. But I think that he has that confidence in his abilities, a manager that has so much confidence in Mason as well. And yeah, when I said 4-2-3-1, I was maybe thinking about how it could be like in the future. I expect us to use 4-3-3 from the start with Mason playing the number 8 role. So, yeah, I'm expecting a very promising season from him.
And someone we've not really talked about, because Chelsea signed him in January, obviously, is Christian Pulisic. And I wonder how excited you are to get the chance to see him in a Chelsea shirt. Do you think he'll be one of those guys who will play a massive role in Lampard's first season?
I'm not too sure about a massive role. I think my stance on Pulisic is, you know what, he's young, very talented, but I think that he just needs time to grow and develop. I think he's one of those players that doesn't need too much pressure put on him. I know, you know, he's like 20 years old, massive transfer value. The entire, you know, he's got an entire continent in America that's going to be actively looking at the player. So I don't think we have to do anything really to start really overhyping him and getting him, you know, feeling the pressure right now.
understand, you know, the club will probably have some expectations from the player, some goal sets for this year. So, yeah, I think that he'll have a good season, but I'm not expecting any fireworks.
How do you feel about the season coming up? Obviously, the transfer ban means you're not bringing any new players and you've got a new manager. But obviously, the season we've just had, you finished third and won the Europa League. That's a high watermark, isn't it? Surely Chelsea can't achieve that again.
I'm not too sure. I think, obviously, with the Champions League, with quite an inexperienced squad too, I'm not expecting us to win it. As long as we play with pride and obviously, you know, give it our best, that's all I can ask for. I think with a lot of young players potentially playing for next season, I think that all the fan base has to manage their expectations. I still think that we're good enough to get a potential top four finish though. So I think that's going to be the most interesting thing to see.
Who are you looking to step up the most now that Eden Hazard's gone? Which player do you think needs to sort of grow into the vacuum that he has left?
Oh, well, there's one player who I think started to fill the role quite nicely as the season was ending last season, and that was Ruben. Now, I know that they don't play in the same position, but I was kind of looking at things from like the talisman perspective. You know, Hazard being that talisman that, you know, he rejuvenates the team, gets them playing better. And whenever I've seen Ruben playing, he's had the same effect on the team. You know, he's got the team playing better. We look sharper. We look more threatening. We start creating more opportunities. And it's a shame that he had such an unfortunate injury because I'd be saying him. But I think, obviously, Hudson-Odoi now that he has the left-hand side free for himself, you know, playing under Frank and Morris again with, you know, potentially playing alongside Mason too, that would be quite exciting to see. So I'm expecting big things from Hudson-Odoi this year.
And one name we haven't mentioned is Tammy Abraham. Are you in the camp where you want to see him playing, if not every week for Chelsea, close to every week?
I think Tammy could be given the opportunity to start every single week. I think, you know, when it comes to the striker position, Batshuayi, I don't think he's our calibre, if I'm being serious. Giroud was great, but he is getting older. And I think when you have such a young, talented player in Tammy Abraham, you know, with this mental desire. And that's one thing I love about the guy. You know, he's one of those winners, you know. He puts us all out there. He plays with, like, this fire in him. And I think the fans will really take to that when they see him play. And the guy's a great finisher. So I'd like to see Tammy starting, getting that confidence, getting used to playing with his new teammates and really, like, you know, getting the best platform to do what he can do.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, actually, even for, you know, as a Liverpool fan, but an England fan as well. I think he's a guy who's got that kind of potential to play at the highest level. Nini, just finally, you heard me introduce our Mystery Voices segment earlier. I'm going to get Ben to play it again, and I'm going to ask for a little bit of your help, if possible, because I'm already struggling with it. Ben, why don't you play it and see if we can't get one of these three?
I don't mind.
I'm good, man.
Please, I'm happy with that.
I'm struggling here, Nini. Have you got any of them?
Yeah, I'm struggling too. For a second there, I thought I was hearing Droops from Arsenal Fan TV. But, I don't think my ears are playing up inside of it.
It's not a terrible shout. Ben's giving me a shake of the head from the box, unfortunately. All right, well, of course, tune in to the end of the show if you want to hear the answers, or check us out on Twitter at Love Sport Radio. Nini, thank you so much for coming on. Always great to have you. Nini FC there, Blue Lions TV. No help whatsoever with the Mystery Voice.
Love Sport.
We should also talk a bit of F1, because I've got Richard Spanners ready. The man known as Spanners to almost everyone is on the line now. And yesterday was a fantastic race at the Austrian Grand Prix, a brilliant drive from Max Verstappen. But the final few hours, and even after the race, all centred around one incident when Verstappen barged up the inside of Charles Leclerc to take the lead in the late stages of the race. Spanners, what do you think? A racing incident or an unfair move?
Well, I have to say, on Mist Apex podcast, we don't ever have racing incidents because we want to assign blame. So we have a section called Whose Fault Is This? Where we look at an incident and we say who is most to blame. And I have to say, most of the panel were perfectly happy with that racing incident. But as you've seen on social media, there is a big kind of schism in F1 over the last few incidents. So we had Vettel in Canada, who was given a penalty when he came back on track and crowded Lewis Hamilton. Ricciardo in Paul Ricard was given penalties for overtaking Kimi Raikkonen off of the track. And there's this big split between people saying, just let them race. It's a man's game. We don't need no stinking rules, James. And then there's people who say, yeah, but we do have rules, so we should enforce them. Which side do you fall on, James? Where do you want us to see our F1 philosophy?
I quite like rules. I'm institutionalised and have been from a young age. And so I do quite like rules, and I think they're important. And the Vettel penalty, I was right behind. And then I looked at it, and, you know, I was quite moved. Well, not moved is the wrong word, but convinced by Pedro De La Rosa on Twitter last night, saying, look, the driver on the outside could pull out and let the guy through, and then there wouldn't be contact. But in the days now that we've got asphalt runoffs, you don't do that. You just get barged wide, and it's fine. And I kind of went along with that. Look, racing's important, but I actually don't think that these overtaking moments are the problems that F1 has. Actually, the problems with F1 are, you know, when you're a second or a second and a half behind a car and you can't stay behind them.
Yeah, and the big problem has been a lack of wheel-to-wheel racing. For a lot of people, we haven't had enough. Actually, this season we've had a fair amount, and that's why we're talking about racing incidents. And to be fair, Pedro De La Rosa is so charming and handsome that I'm inclined to agree with him whatever he says.
However,
in this case, there is a big disconnect between the precedents set by cars on the outside having to yield and give way, and what the rules actually say. So, I mean, if you look at Lewis Hamilton, he used to do that to Rosberg time and time again. USA, Suzuka, he did it in Canada as well. He would just really show Rosberg all the way to the outside of the track, and Rosberg would just jump out of the way. But there is a rule. There is a rule at the moment which says you cannot crowd a car off the track. So you cannot drive your car in a manner that forces another driver to drive off track. So by the letter of the law, and to be consistent, Verstappen probably should have got a penalty there. However, if I was a steward surrounded by that sea of orange yesterday, no way would I have wanted to give Verstappen a penalty, rob him of the win, and then fight my way through that crowd. I think there is an element of people listening to the political will and not wanting to ruin the spectacle. But Formula One fans would not survive well, I think, in other sports. Can you imagine an LBW decision and the umpire says, well, it would have hit the wicket. However, we want to see Tendulkar batting. So, no, I'm sorry, he's in. And that, for me, that's kind of where we are with the rules at the moment.
Yeah, it's sort of the famous WG Grace. They didn't come here to watch you bowl, lad. They came to watch me bat. Exactly. Moving away from these inevitable stewarding inquiries, how much did F1 need that brilliant race yesterday after a horrendously Merck-dominated season?
Oh, well, I mean, F1 died at Paul Ricard, if you listen to clickbait F1 and some of the more toxic elements of F1 social media and online content creation. But there's quite a few people who gave up on F1. And I hope the ones who ducked out after a boring race in Paul Ricard, you know, didn't get to see this spectacle. This was a fantastic example of Formula One. And I don't want to be that guy that says, I've been watching F1 since 1986. But I've been watching F1 since 1986. and the pattern is boring, 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 quite good, boring, boring, classic. Oh my God, F1's amazing, boring again. So that is the way it goes. So yes, maybe in this day and age where we demand a little bit more, we demand it instantly, we did need it, but it was always going to come. F1 will deliver surprising races. And you have to remember, we've had regulation changes this season. And when you have regulation changes, you're surprised at which tracks suit the regulations, and which tracks like Baku, which have given us some really dramatic races, suddenly seem very dull.
Yeah, obviously no Lewis Hamilton on the podium, which is pretty rare, I have to say. What do you put that down to? Obviously, he picked up that penalty in qualifying, which really didn't help him.
It didn't help. I mean, we should definitely say this is the Max Verstappen show, and it certainly was the Max Verstappen show in Austria. But Mercedes suffered with a few problems, the first being that they just couldn't get their engine cool enough. So they were actually running a safe mode in their engine yesterday because they're thinking of the championship. They don't want that engine to explode. You're only allowed 3 power units through the course of the season, so they didn't want it to cook. And remember, they still scored, you know, a third place and a fifth place. It's not a complete disaster. But they couldn't fight back. The other thing was Lewis Hamilton, who has been nearly flawless all season, actually had a bit of a scrappy race and kept running wide. He kept hitting the aggressive curbs, and he ended up with front wing damage. So not only did he have that penalty, which was his fault, and it was a deserved penalty for impeding Kimi Raikkonen in qualifying, he also then had to change his front wing. And it was only him and Max Verstappen who really had a chance to overtake those front runners yesterday, and Hamilton took himself out. I believe that was his error. But if you see Verstappen start, he actually anti-stalled on the line, and he ended up from second place all the way back in eighth place. But that actually did him a favour. So when all the front runners were having to scrap around and tactically choose their time to pit stop to protect themselves from the cars behind, Verstappen had a free run. He pitted about 10 laps later, and that's why he had the fresh tyres to go through. But I will say, James, I don't think every driver in that situation would have been able to fight through. He was aggressive, he was daring, he was dynamic, and he is very much a feature of Formula One.
Just finally, McLaren is something that used to be a feature of Formula One and then briefly became a shopping trolley for about 5 years. But a brilliant day for them, and great for sort of British fans, especially because it's such a historic team, to see Lando Norris, a young British guy in a McLaren, competing. You know, when he was going wheel to wheel with Hamilton on the second lap, I couldn't quite believe what I was seeing. But he backed it up. He finished, sixth on the day, best of the rest, as you might say. How good is this McLaren? Is this a watershed moment for them?
Oh, you know, it's almost a bit like damning with faint praise, though, James. You have to remember that McLaren are a team that have won a championship more recently than Ferrari. So, yes, relatively speaking, it's better than the GP2 engine McLaren Honda that was going around in 2014, but it still represents, you know, some way to go. But let's talk about Lando Norris, because he is definitely a bright young star. This is only his ninth Grand Prix, James. He's absolutely incredible. He had a great interview before the race where he said, "Do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to have a nice, sensible start, but I mustn't ruin my race fighting with the likes of Mercedes, fighting with the likes of Ferrari, who I'm not in a race with." Mm. What happens turn one? Finds himself alongside Lewis Hamilton and says, "No, you don't. I don't fancy letting you pass."
The
and
racer takes over, doesn't he?
And when he got overtaken by both Hamilton and Vettel, he came back at both of them. Mm. And that actually cost him, because Kimi Raikkonen's Alfa Romeo managed to get past him. You know, he did get that place back. But yeah, you can't undo the racer instinct as much as he'd like to.
No, absolutely not. Spanners, thank you so much for coming on. Always a pleasure. Richard Spanners ready there. If you want to hear more of Spanners, by the way, he's part of the Missed Apex podcast. Well worth checking out wherever you get your podcasts. Always good for a steward's inquiry after a race in particular. Richard Spanners ready there. Spanners of the Missed Apex podcast.
Love sports.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle
with ultra titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water.
But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time.
For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
And there's plenty to clean up today. Well, at least there's plenty to clean up in Newcastle. Rafa Benitez's contract expired yesterday, of course, after they failed to agree a deal with him. Probably the best manager they've had since, Bobby Robson. And they failed to agree a new contract. He's going to walk away with nowhere to go. He's released a statement on his social media today. Credit to him, you know, Rafa. You wouldn't expect anything less, but he waited until he was officially gone to speak out. You know, when things came out last week, you know, there was an announcement last week. He was told by a friend that he was leaving the club. They had been in talks, and I know they've been in talks for a long time at Newcastle, but he was told by a friend, "Oh, by the way, Raf, they've announced that you're leaving Newcastle on the website." And he went, oh, am I? Right, okay, very good. Great. So, not only that, but he also has been in these protracted and very acrimonious talks where basically Mike Ashley's the only bloke who doesn't want to give him a new contract. Now, this is what he said on social media. He said, "I wanted to stay. I wanted to be part of the project. It became increasingly clear to me that those at the top of the club did not share the same vision. I'm very sad about that, but I do not for one moment regret my decision to come to Tyneside, and I'm very proud about what we achieved there." And what they achieved, by the way, was Benitez got them back out from the championship at the first time of asking. They won the championship, of course, came up as champions, and then top half finish in the Premier League. Now, don't underestimate how impressive that is, given that he had almost no investment from above him. And that's where the BS in this particular case comes. Newcastle have been mismanaged for many, many years. But this really does highlight what they're doing wrong. It's easy to sit there and say, you know, as a fan or as an armchair supporter, "Oh, well, we've not spent any money." And it's like, well, actually, it's not as simple as that. You know, Bournemouth haven't spent much money, but they've stayed in the Premier League and they have a cohesive strategy. And when you hear what Rafa's saying. When you hear him say, I wanted to be part of a project, but they didn't have the same vision as me, that tells you an awful lot about what's going on at that club. Because it's not, I wanted to be part of a specific project. I wanted to be part of a project. You know, he wanted to be part of something where they felt they were moving forward. And I think that's the same in everyone. You know, and as a footballing person, you want to be part of something that feels like you're building. You don't want to be part of something where you're basically just keeping your head above water. You're just trying to stay in the same place, swimming against the tide, desperately trying to hang on to things. As a footballing person, you want to be part of that. And if you have a strategy that you can sell to these people, it's easy to keep top talent at the club. And let's face it, Rafa Benitez is someone who they needed to keep at the club because he is a top manager. He's won La Liga titles. He's won the Champions League. He's won the Europa League, remember, with Chelsea, who didn't even want him there. But anyway, he is someone who has achieved what no other Newcastle manager now for many, many years will have achieved. They're not going to get someone of that calibre, I guarantee you. Under Ashley, they're just surviving. They're treading water. It's all they're even striving for. They're not even accidentally treading water by failing to achieve. They're just not interested in anything anymore. And that's all well and good to a certain extent. You know, there are different ways to skin a rabbit, and not every club in the Premier League has to be run the same way. But there are so many more problems beyond that that they've created with it. You know, for a start, the fan base. The people who are the lifeblood of the club. The lads who stand on the terraces, and I know they're not terraces anymore, but they still stand, so they're still terraces to me, with their shirt off in December, you know, singing the Blean Races. And who've basically got black and white tattoos striped up and down their body. The people who are in Newcastle and beyond there, because it is a global club, they're not used to that attitude. It's not why they love the club. You know, football fandom in the modern era is not something you're born with and you die with. You can become and you can stop being a football fan. You can fall in and fall out of love with a club. And this is a club that for 15 years were right up there in English football and gained that fan base because they fell in love with trying to achieve something. Even if Newcastle didn't always achieve things and didn't always win trophies, goodness, they tried. They got to consecutive FA Cup finals. They had days in the sun where they battered big teams because they had the players who could do it. They had the managers who could do it. They had the ambition to do it. And now they don't. Those people who fell in love with that club will fall out of love with it. They will start to switch off or not turn up or even boycott the club. And then what is it worth? Take away all the footballing and all the emotional, the romantic elements. What is the club worth if the fan base starts to switch off? Because then Ashley doesn't have a club that he can sell. He has a husk of a club which he can't get 350 million quid for. All it becomes is a massive Sports Direct billboard in quite an underprivileged part of the world. I don't understand what he thinks he's going to get out of not keeping Rafa Benitez, not keeping top talent, because even sitting down with players, you have to sell them the dream. You have to sell them the project and say, look, here's our five-year plan. Sure, it might not come off, but we think we can achieve this, this, and this. You have to at least pretend to believe, because everyone who's ever become a footballer has at some point in their life had to suspend their disbelief. They've had to go, yeah, there's a really slim chance of me getting a contract, but I've got to try, I've got to dream. Every footballer is a dreamer. Every football manager is a dreamer. Every fan, every supporter, every journalist, they all just dream and hope that they might one day win something. Newcastle fans can't do that anymore. They can't do it. And frankly, I don't know what sort of manager can get that back for them in the way that Rafa did. Take Tommy Cassidy, a Newcastle legend who was on Love Sport Breakfast, and he said they now need someone who understands the fans in the same way that Rafa did.
Well, I think it's the two very experienced managers. Personally, I'm not a Mourinho fan. I've never been, actually, over the years. Ranieri could do a good job, but you need an experienced manager to do this job, without a doubt. Newcastle certainly is not an easy job. The supporters, well, I'm biased, obviously, but the supporters are the best supporters in the world, in my opinion. And it's not an easy job to satisfy them.
It's not. And I understand that, and I don't envy any Newcastle boss because the pressure of expectation is huge. But Rafa got them on side because he got it. And I don't necessarily know how he did that. You know, he's a charismatic bloke. But I don't necessarily know how he went there and the fans immediately went, bang, we like this guy. I think the signing they could do a lot worse than is Chris Hughton. I've said that a couple of times. He would be very popular up there. I know they thought he was unlucky, the majority of fans, not to get a new contract when he was there. I thought he was unlucky to get rid of at Brighton. The question is, do Newcastle fans want someone who plays the sort of football Chris Hughton does? Because it's not going to be particularly exciting. That seems not to be his way. I don't know if he can adapt. I'm sure he can. But whether he will is another thing. It's not going to be easy for Newcastle this season. I desperately hope that we're not talking about another Newcastle United relegation, because it's one of the great grounds in English football. It's great having those massive crowds there every week. I don't want to watch that in the Championship again. But I can't, at the moment, see a way how that's not going to happen.
Love Sport.
On Monday, the 1st of July, and it's significant. I'm not just reading out the date because I'm some sort of Rain Man and just like, you know, repeating the date and the time. But the 1st of July is a significant date for all players because contracts tend to run until the 30th of June. We've seen Rafa Benitez's contract expire in the last day. And we know that a lot of players have been released by their clubs on Monday morning. We'll have to start the hunt for a new side. Not a pleasant one, I'm sure. And what we've done is had a little look around and tried to say, if you were starting a brand new football club tomorrow, you don't have any transfer fees available to spend, and you're going to pick up 11 players on a free. Who are you going to get? Now, Ben and I immediately argued about this because we started off with goalkeepers and he had one view and I had another. Michel Vorm has just been released by Tottenham. And apparently, his League Cup medal wasn't good enough for Ben. Apparently some bloke called Gigi Buffon has won the World Cup. I don't remember. Ben, I think you're an idiot because he's 41. He's not had a good time at PSG. Failed to nail down the number one spot, quite frankly. He got supplanted by that Areola bloke, didn't he? It's obviously an objectively funny name, but anyway, that's why I remembered it. But Buffon's been released. He only had a year there. Surely, and my notes say, amended by Ben, surely the keeper's worth a punt if just for his experience alone. No. No, he wears a snood. But he is nevertheless our Transfer 11 goalkeeper. Heck of a back four this, although not a lot of defending, probably. Alberto Moreno, Gary Cahill, Diego Godin, although he has just signed for Inter Milan, so we're going to miss out on him, and Dani Alves. Now, honestly, I don't think I'd take Dani Alves, because he's obviously going to cost you a huge amount of wages. And yes, as it says here, not as athletic as he once was. Could do the job for a lower league club. Yeah, that's a good idea, Ben, actually. I reckon Fleetwood Town might quite fancy Dani Alves. Go and play under Joe Barton or something. Yeah, that would work, wouldn't it? No, I don't think so. In the tennis, by the way, Simona Halep is through in straight sets as well. Former world number one and champion. Gary Cahill. Now, Fulham tried to sign him in January. They got as far as giving him a tour of the training ground, would you believe it? But no such luck. I assume the wages were the stumbling block here. But he's only 33, which for a defender is not that old. He's been going pretty well when he has played, frankly. He's not really had an opportunity at Chelsea, almost at all. So I'm kind of impressed. I think Gary Cahill would be one I would definitely go for. Alberto Moreno, meanwhile, look, I've watched a lot of him. I've met him, actually. I've met him and his wife and his brother and his brother's wife. Don't ask the circumstances of that. There was a lot of red wine involved, put it that way. I don't think I would ever really want Alberto Moreno in any circumstances. Let's move into the midfield, shall we? We're sort of deploying a 4-4-2 system, although, oh, maybe. It's quite an attacking 4-4-2, let's be honest. The midfield, Adrian Rabiot and Ander Herrera. Now, this is interesting because these are two blokes who could sort of replace each other. Ander Herrera has still not officially signed a deal with Paris Saint-Germain, which is pretty interesting. Who knows what the stumbling block is there, but apparently he's got a two-year deal on the table that's going to earn him about £350,000 a week. I don't know why he hasn't signed that, because if you offered me that kind of money, I don't think you'd be able to see me before I signed it. I would only be in a room with a contract, furiously scribbling. Adrien Rabiot, by the way, is of course leaving Paris Saint-Germain this summer. I think that is a massive, massive opportunity for any club in need of a midfielder who can have an impact. Frankly, there are plenty of midfielders who, or clubs, sorry, I should say, who need a midfielder like that. Rabiot, for all his personal problems, and I know he's a difficult person sometimes, I think he should be someone that almost any club would look at and say, yeah, he can add something. Barcelona, Liverpool, Manchester United, all been linked. Now looks as though he's going to go to Juventus. And by the way, if you're Maurizio Sarri and you pick up Adrian Rabiot on a free, what an 11 you've got to start next season with. You've already got Cristiano Ronaldo. You've already got Aaron Ramsey, Mario Mandzukic, if you will. There is some absolute talent in that Juventus team now. And if they pick up Rabiot as well, this is really gonna make them a force. You know, a midfield of Pjanic, Rabiot and Ramsey. They've already got, what, Szczesny? They might get Matthias de Ligt as well. Dybala, Douglas Costa, De Ciglio. How are that Juve team not going to win the Champions League? Seriously. They could also pick up, if they want a couple more free transfers, Franck Ribéry, Iron Robin, both away from Bayern Munich this summer. No lack of experience, although there might be some issues around signing Franck Ribéry. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that. The lawyer looks concerned that I'm going to go in that direction, but I'm not going to. It's fine. He needs to decide whether his career's over. Robin, obviously, is 35, but he has been 35 for the last 15 years, so maybe he's not really aging. And then up front, if you want the most injured front two of all time, you can look no further than Danny Sturridge and Andy Carroll on a free transfer, the both of them. They both come with their own doctor and physio, so that should help take a bit of cost away. Look, I feel sorry for both of them. Carroll's not always been his own biggest friend, frankly, not keeping himself in shape, not behaving properly, you know, which would have helped. If he kept his weight off a little bit more, probably wouldn't have gone through quite the number of injuries, but, you know, that's the risk you take when you sign Andy Carroll. Daniel Sturridge, meanwhile, injured almost constantly as well. It's a heck of an 11. If you like it, if you don't like it, head over to @LoveSportRadio. We'll sling that free transfer 11 on Twitter. But that 11 is going to cost you a grand total of £0 and 0 pence. And when you consider that you could sign someone like Marouane Fellaini for £27 million. And the reason I think of this transfer is because the other person whose contract has expired today is David Moyes, or at least it would have done. His initial Manchester United contract would have expired yesterday. Can you believe that? The bloke who became Manchester United manager in 2013, he was anointed by Fergie, and 6 years to the day he took over at United. He was sacked less than a year later after 15 defeats in 51 games. The list of problems of David Moyes' reign. He signed Fellaini, as I mentioned, for £27 million. A couple of days previous, his minimum fee release clause was £25 million, which David Moyes would have well known, having been Marouane Fellaini's manager at Everton. He had United's worst league start for 24 years. He, of course, fell out with star scorer Robin van Persie. He had the most losses in a Premier League season for United, and to top it all off, he failed to qualify for the Champions League.
Love Sport.
A man who's not got quite so much to do today is Rafa Benitez, because his contract has expired at Newcastle yesterday. We, of course, heard last week that he'd failed to come to an agreement with Mike Ashley. Let's speak to Chris Waugh, who's on the line now. Newcastle United reporter for The Chronicle, of course. Famous old paper up there. Chris, no surprise that Rafa's gone, of course, but the statement today as well, sort of unsurprising, typically classy from Benitez.
Yeah, I mean, the statement that Benitez released wasn't necessarily revelatory in the fact that everything he said within it was widely reported and already known. He'd hinted at it in a lot of public statements he'd made before his contract negotiations broke down with Newcastle. But yeah, very classy. He said that he felt he belonged at St. James's Park and with the Newcastle fans, and that he built a real rapport with them. He insisted he did not want to leave, and basically said that the reason that he did go in the end was because he didn't just want to sign a contract to stay for another while longer. He wanted to sign a contract to be able to progress and for his ambition to be fulfilled. And basically he says in a not so veiled way that Newcastle United did not show the same ambition, and therefore he felt he couldn't stay, and that's why no agreement was reached.
When he says he wanted to be part of a project but that vision wasn't shared, what do you think in that conversation, how do you think that went? You know, Rafa goes, well, I want to spend a bit of money and try and penetrate the top seven, and Mike Ashley goes, no, I'm not going to spend any money. Finishing 13th is fine every year. Is that about right?
probably not in as many words, but it's, I think that's the sort of gist, really. Yeah, I mean, Benitez wanted to eventually start competing for the top eight. He wanted to get Newcastle back into Europe. He wanted to really compete in domestic trophies, which Newcastle have an appalling record in during the Mike Ashley era. They've never got past the FA Cup fourth round since Mike Ashley's been owner. And basically, there was a lot of issues. It wasn't just over transfer budget, although that was a concern. He was basically told he would have about 50 to 60 million to spend this summer. He thinks other clubs will spend more and therefore Newcastle eventually will get left behind. But it was also, he wanted the training ground restructured. Newcastle have one of the least up-to-date training grounds in the Premier League, whereas other clubs are spending 10 to 15 to 20 million on theirs. Newcastle's hasn't really had a full upgrade in quite a while. There's only been really little bits and bobs improved in it. He wanted to change the whole academy structure. Basically, it was a difference in vision that he wanted Newcastle to think big, and under the current owner, he has no real ambition to put any more money into it. He won't put any more of his personal finances in. And he really is looking to sell. So basically, Benitez just thought that survival was the only real objective. Newcastle contest otherwise, but at the moment they haven't represented the case to show that is the case.
Looking forward now, as Newcastle fans have to do, life after Rafa must go on. Who is the favourite for the job at the moment? Who do you think will get it?
I can't give one specific name yet, and primarily that's because as of last Monday, Newcastle hadn't even really considered life after Benitez. They were had maintained all along he was the only manager they wanted. They've had a week now to reassess. They had a long list of names last week. They're starting to put together a short list. I think that the likelihood is, though, that Newcastle will probably go more towards, rather than Benitez, who insisted on the title of manager before him, Steve McLaren was head coach. And I think that the soundings are, and this hasn't been confirmed, but the soundings are that they will go more towards that sort of model. So someone who comes in will not necessarily have the final say on transfers. They'll have a significant input, but not the final say, as Benitez had written into his contract. And so I think that a continental sort of manager, Patrick Vieira has already ruled himself out, but someone like Mikel Arteta or one of the names who's been linked, Giovanni Van Bronckhorst, I think someone like that's the most likely route for Newcastle to go down. And there are certainly, despite the situation Newcastle are in, there's certainly plenty of managers out there who would want the job.
Well, I was going to say, are there that many managers out there who want it? Because to me, working for Mike Ashley sounds like an absolutely lunatic idea.
Yeah, well, it's a surprising thing. I wrote a thing over the weekend basically saying, look, particularly European managers who are looking for a first opportunity in the Premier League, this could be the chance for them, whereby a lot of structures that you get on the continent, you don't necessarily have the final say on transfers, so working within that sort of remit is not necessarily alien to them. There's also a lot of out-of-work managers in England at the moment, or those in the lower leagues who are ambitious and want an opportunity. And at the end of the day, yes, you're working under Mike Ashley, who's far from the ideal owner, but at the same time, Newcastle United remain a massive football club. They're a Premier League football club. And if Newcastle United come calling, a lot of people will feel that they can't turn that down as long as they're given assurances to a degree. I don't think that any of them will be afforded anywhere near the power Benitez was, but as long as they're given some autonomy to a degree and are given the chance to take Newcastle forward, there will be a lot of interest in it, and there already has been. I know for a fact that plenty of managers have already applied.
Just finally, Chris, in terms of transfer spend this summer, in terms of what Newcastle fans can expect from their team next year, is it going to be another 17th of a bit result?
Well, at the moment, I mean, there's some Newcastle fans are already fearing the worst and already fearing relegation, given the turmoil they find themselves in now. 1st of July, don't have a manager, haven't made any progress in the transfer market, takeover situation uncertain, so I'm not sure if Mike Ashley's going to be owner. I don't think that Newcastle are going to lavishly spend. They've made it clear they've got about 50 to 60 million. They prefer to sign younger players under the age of 25 with potential sell-on value. Exciting players, so I think that Newcastle at the moment are going to face a bit of a struggle. I hope I'm wrong, and I hope they can get an exciting manager and some very good players in, but at the moment, given the turmoil that they appear to be in, I think that there's a nervous wait for the rest of summer to see what unfolds.
Chris, thanks so much for giving us that update and joining us here on the James Gray Show. Chris War there, Newcastle United reporter for The Chronicle, one of the great old papers. I actually went and did a course there once upon a time. I've seen the very printing presses where the newspaper itself is printed, and who knows whose name will be on the back page of it in the next couple of weeks. It won't be Rafa Benitez, as of course his contract expired yesterday, and Newcastle United are now beginning the hunt for a new manager. The baffling thing to me is that a week ago, when they knew Rafa was going, they had no idea who they were going to bring in.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. Remember to leave us a rating and a review, but only nice ones. I don't take criticism well.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.